80% of companies determine profit contribution on a customer-by-customer basis. Instead, many just assume that all business is good business. In this lecture, we're going to try to obliterate that assumption. We're going to see how to come up with more precise numbers that show you how different customers affect your business. We're going to bring the lights up and see how our resources are consumed. As a result, we'll be able to make decisions based on knowledge as opposed to flimsy assumptions. You might be tempted to ask, though, what is an accounting topic doing in an operations course? Trust me, I'm no accounting enthusiast, but the method I'm going to show you is central to deciding what business to pursue and how to serve that business operationally. In short, it helps us to right-size the product and service provision in light of the revenues and margins earned on the business. After all, executing your product and service strategy is what operations are all about. Let's start by framing the problem a little bit more precisely. All businesses are required to perform traditional financial accounting, generating reports such as the income statement, balance sheet, and statement of cash flows. Most also maintain a general ledger to document inflows and outflows of capital. These are financial accounting practices that are required for legal and tax purposes. We follow the rules set forward by regulatory bodies and tax agencies with generally accepted accounting principles or GAAP standards set forward by the Financial Accounting Standards Board, or FASB. Here, every penny in the business is accounted for, and we get good reads on the general state of the business. That's all good, but it doesn't provide us with the insight that we need to make fully informed decisions that help us run our businesses better. This is often regarded as the difference between financial accounting and managerial accounting. Financial accounting is the have-to-do variety versus the want-to-do variety achieved with managerial accounting. Both are essential to an organization, and both speak to the financial health and vitality of the business. I'd like to emphasize managerial accounting, which is intended to provide management with insights for informed business decisions solely for the purposes internal to the company. Not all businesses apply the suite of managerial accounting methods. Some organizations dedicate a lot of time and resources to these extracurricular analyses, and others do virtually none of it, instead relying on gut feel to make decisions big and small. This might be fine for really small organizations, like new startups that generate very few products and serve a limited number of customers. You can literally watch the cash register and see how money comes and goes in the business. However, over time, and with any luck, success drives business to grow. Before long, customers start asking for variations in the products and services offered. Naturally, you're eager to accommodate these wishes, to follow the money trail and get ingrained with customers. Before long, you realize that you're doing something a little bit different for everyone. There's no longer such a thing as a standard product or service, and every one of those little customizations has its own unique resources and cost. You push onward, for the top-line revenues continue to grow. Who doesn't like seeing top-line growth? Pretty soon, your small business isn't so small anymore, and it's complicated too. Where you used to have a strong sense for what was good business and what was bad business to pursue, you no longer quite know. The cause and effect relationship between how you expend your resources and generate your income has become a muddled mess. At the end of each month, quarter, or year, you take a tally of the money that came in and the money that went out, but all you can really do is hope to win more often than you lose, so that at the end of the day, week, or month, you enjoy a good financial return. It doesn't need to be that way. Let's talk about how to bring those lights up, to figure out where you're making money and where you're losing money. What you need is a more advanced level of margin analysis. You can generate it on a product-by-product or product-line-by-product-line basis. It can also be generated on a service-by-service basis or on a customer-by-customer basis. When examining customers as the focus, you'll look at the products and services that each customer buys from you. An even more advanced version would allow you to look at the contribution of an individual product or service sold to each unique customer. Now, that's a little advanced for our purposes. So this lecture, we'll focus on understanding the contribution margin on a customer-by-customer basis. Let's talk about what I mean when I say a customer-by-customer contribution analysis. Is that really possible? Well, it depends on your business and its complexity. If you're a consumer service organization, a retail business, or a dot-com business selling to the masses, you probably don't need to run a unique analysis on each and every customer. It would be too taxing to do, and you probably wouldn't learn enough to justify that effort. Rather, you'd look at the types of customers, what they typically ask for and buy in the way of products and services. This is what marketers call segmenting the customer base, breaking the market up into smaller chunks or groupings of customers that look and act alike in terms of what they demand and buy from you. So instead of dealing with thousands of distinct customers, you might divide them into, say, 5 to 10 groups based on what they buy from you. But if you're a business that sells to other businesses, then your customer count is probably a lot lower, as you sell considerably larger volumes to a smaller number of customers. However, really big business-to-business marketers may still have a customer count that numbers into the thousands, which requires you to simplify the analysis too. I would encourage business-to-business sellers to isolate their largest customers from everyone else. The remaining customers can then be segmented, as I described in the consumer marketing example a moment ago. Statistical methods can help to isolate the key dimensions of buying behavior and collapse thousands of customers into a much lower and more manageable number of groups or segments. Most companies see the 80-20 rule applying to their business. The 80-20 rule suggests that 80% of a company's revenues come from 20% of its customers. That means that you have a relatively small number of customers that are disproportionately important to your business when you look at how revenues are generated. Those vital few customers that generate the massive sales for your business are the ones that call for individualized attention. But remember that your focus should be on margin, not sales. What really matters here is getting to an understanding of what I call differential resource consumption. That's a fancy way of saying, let's figure out which customers force us to consume what resources in the business. To appreciate what we're trying to accomplish here, allow me to contrast it with traditional cost allocation methods, the most traditional of which is average costing. As its name implies, average costing simply divides a cost by the number of customers you serve to arrive at an average cost. Consider, for instance, the cost of answering a customer's inquiry over the phone. The average cost method would simply look at all the costs associated with customer phone inquiries, including the cost of the call center facility, the phone lines, and employee time, and divide this sum by the number of inquiries that customers make. So if we spend $200,000 per year on supporting customer inquiries and we answer 200,000 calls, then the cost per call is $1. We might then use this average cost per call to make decisions about how we staff the call center, either expanding it or reducing it, Or we might even compare this cost to what outsiders would charge us for the same service, whether to insource or outsource the call center function. But the average costing method is sorely lacking in accuracy and insights. For average costing implies that all of our customer inquiries were equally resource intensive. But I think we'll agree that this isn't the case, right? Some calls might last just a few seconds, others a few minutes, and perhaps others more than an hour when an inquiry is really complex or the customer wants to unload on you in a big way. To underscore the need for something better than average costing, imagine the following scenario. You and a group of friends decide to go out for a nice dinner. You're looking forward to a fun evening, but don't want to blow your whole paycheck on the meal. But there's that one guy in your party. We'll call him Steve. And Steve's living like it's the last evening on earth. Appetizers? Sure, he'll have a couple. The surf or the turf? Steve opts for both. And when it's time for dessert, hey, why not? And a nice port wine to go with it. You see where I'm going with this, right? The check arrives at the table, and what does Steve suggest? Let's split it evenly, he says. Like our friend Steve, not all of our customers consume resources equally. And when we rely on average costing to drive our decisions, we're making that very assumption, that service provisions consume resources equally across our customers. And as a result, companies that rely on average costing are subsidizing their most taxing customers. That is, customers that don't ask for much pick up part of the tab that our demanding customers force us to incur. And this is a major problem, because as I noted at the outset of the lecture, most companies assume that their biggest customers, the ones that generate the most revenue, are the best customers in terms of profit contribution. Yet many of these big customers can be pretty demanding to serve. And when you apply charges for the resources they force you to consume, you might find that these big sales customers are not your most profitable customers. Instead, when we focus on what activities we perform for whom, we can get a much richer understanding of how our resources are consumed. As a result, we can make much more informed decisions on how we want to dedicate our resources in the future. What we need to devise is a cost-to-serve analysis. An analysis that expresses the cost of serving specific customers, or when that's not possible, the cost to serve different groups or types of customers who behave in a similar fashion. When you subtract the cost to serve a customer from revenue earned on that business, you arrive at the customer contribution, and that's our goal. There are three primary steps and considerations to getting to that customer contribution. First, get a handle on your business resources and expenses. Review the balance sheet for the resources and examine financial reports like the statement of cash flows and general ledger to see how money is spent in the business. We'll need to refer to these again later, so just get familiar with them for now. Second, examine the activities performed in your business. What processes and activities are performed in order to serve your customers? In operations, we tend to focus on the activities performed from the time of customer order placement through delivery and collection of payment. This includes key processes like order processing, producing a product or service, and order fulfillment and delivery. Of course, you can also incorporate activities like sales and marketing that take place before the order and after payment. The point is that you want to hone in on the activities that are unique or in some way involve different types or levels of resource consumption across the different customers you serve. For instance, if the invoicing process is automated and involves no human effort, Don't bother with that process. Whether it takes a computer 1/10 or 1/100th of a second to generate an invoice is of no concern for us in this analysis. If, however, invoicing isn't automated and takes time for customer service and accounts receivable personnel to complete, and some customers involve more or different steps and therefore cost more to process, then include it. By linking the first step about resources to the second step about activities, we'll devise a cost per activity. How much does it cost to do something? In order to make that translation of resources to cost, we borrow from a technique called activity-based costing. Activity-based costing, or ABC as it's known, is a method made popular by Professor Robert Kaplan. You may recall that he's one half of the duo that devised the balanced scorecard for performance measurement. As its name implies, ABC focuses on the activities that a business performs and how these activities consume resources. In conducting an activity-based analysis, we typically focus on one or two so-called cost objects. These are products or customers. So you can either focus on how we consume resources to produce products and services, or we can cut the analysis another way by looking at how resources are consumed on a customer-by-customer basis. Again, we're looking at customers in the current analysis, so the customer is our cost object. In linking resources to activities, it's helpful to map out the activities you perform for your customers. Literally, draw them out. And with the work steps iterated from beginning to end, we explore the method of process mapping in the process thinking lecture. With the process map, you can link the resources and ensuing cost to each step in the process. What people are involved? What materials? How much of each goes into delivering the outcome of the activity? This might require some observation and inquiry to arrive at making this linkage. One way to simplify this analysis is to focus on a singular cost driver for each activity. A cost driver is something that strongly influences the cost of the activity. As the driver activity increases, the activity cost increases in kind. And when driver activity decreases, so too does activity cost. In other words, a good driver is one that correlates closely with the cost of the activity. If the activity level increases by 50% for the cost driver, the cost for that activity should also increase by about 50%. Let's think of a specific activity. Say, delivering goods to your customers. What might be a good driver for delivery cost? Perhaps time or distance? If you deliver over long distances, like across states, then maybe distance is a good cost driver. The further you drive, the more transportation and delivery cost you will incur. But if you deliver locally or in a small region, then time might be a better cost driver. Consider that some deliveries can be completed quickly in the middle of the day or night, whereas others might take place during the peak traffic times, during morning or evening rush in an urban environment. And as a result, the distance might be the same, but the time varies considerably, consuming more of the delivery personnel time, more fuel, and other resources associated with the delivery. The determination of the proper or best driver is a judgment call and not always obvious. It can be debated, maybe even argued. The key is to strive for consensus. To get there, it's important to understand that it doesn't have to be a perfect driver. There's no need to seek perfection here. Let's try to be basically right. Okay, back to the analysis. We're not concerned with applying the cost to customers just yet. That's the next big step. At this point, our concern is getting to that cost per activity. So let's say we spent $20,000 on customer deliveries last month. including the cost of fuel, maintenance of the delivery equipment, and paying our loaders and delivery people. And let's say that we decided to use mileage as our cost driver for the delivery expense, and we covered 10,000 miles last month in making those deliveries. Dividing the $20,000 delivery expense by 10,000, we calculate a cost of $2 per mile. So each time we make a delivery, we accept a standard cost of $2 per mile. You would make similar calculations for the variety of activities you perform in a customer transaction to arrive at a cost for each activity, like a cost per order acquisition, producing the product or service item, preparing a product for shipping, delivery, invoicing, and closing out the sale. Now we can proceed to the third step in the analysis, determining the cost to serve for each of the customers and segments. Here we need to devise or refer to any existing activity logs or records of how much activity goes toward each customer. What you'll find is that different customers demand different levels of activity. A customer will only be assigned cost for the activities the customer asks you to perform. And this is where we depart vigorously from average costing, where we assign cost to customers irrespective of the specific service provision and actual activities performed. We allowed subsidization of customers under that simple scheme, and our friend Steve benefited from that on our evening out. Not anymore. Now with the activity-based method, we're holding individual customers accountable for demanded activities. Steve might want to hit the ATM machine on his way to dinner. Let's look back at our delivery example to see how this works. Suppose we deliver to a customer located 30 miles away or 60 miles round trip and apply that $2 per mile we calculated earlier. 60 miles times $2 per mile gives us $120 for each delivery to that customer. How much delivery cost should we assign to a customer that picks up at our store or warehouse, requiring us to incur no transportation cost? Nothing. It's not fair in our analysis or in life to assign a delivery cost to a customer that doesn't ask us to incur it. By marrying the cost per activity and activity level for each customer, we get the cost per activity for each customer. We must then sum up the cost across the various activities we perform for the customer to arrive at the total cost to serve the customer on a transaction. To revisit our dinner outing, instead of everyone splitting one big bill evenly, each person gets a bill based on the items that he or she ordered. That was easy. Now, I won't lie to you, it's not easy. But allow me to offer a couple of hints that make this kind of analysis much easier. First, don't quibble about every penny in the business. That's the worry of financial accounting. With managerial accounting, we strive to be basically right. A 90% solution will do just fine. Try to be more right than wrong. But paralysis by analysis can easily sideline your effort. The second hint, and this is a big one, only include the cost that would go away if your cost object went away. So if we focus our analysis on customers, how much it cost us to serve different ones, only include the cost that would go away if a specific customer went away. Going back to our delivery example, would we shut down our warehouse if we lost a specific customer? No, probably not. Would we reduce the size of the facility if we lost a customer? Again, no, we probably wouldn't. So don't worry about how we split the fixed cost of the facility when doing this analysis. Too often, accountants and managers quibble over how to split these fixed costs. To be honest, I don't know of a good way. And I'm not sure that there is a good way. So don't include them in the analysis. In essence, What that means is that we're conducting a contribution analysis instead of a fully loaded profit and loss analysis. We're still going to have to consider how to pay the bills for our facilities and other fixed costs, but the contribution analysis will help us to understand which customers are contributing to the coverage of these fixed costs. With these two simple rules, you can take the customer contribution analysis from an impossible dream to a very attainable one. Of course, once you have the figures, you need to revisit them from time to time. As new services are introduced, or the cost of performing existing services changes. But the point is, with this initial analysis, we can start to understand where we're winning and losing on a customer-by-customer basis. What would you do, for instance, if you found that on a given sales transaction with a customer that you charge, say, $300 per order, and it turns out that it costs you $350 to fulfill each one of those orders? You're losing money with each and every transaction. And don't expect to make it up with more transactions or larger sales to that customer. You might only dig yourself deeper into a hole. Sadly, this is a very common occurrence. An analysis for a large U.S. manufacturer revealed that nearly 40% of transactions that they conducted were at a loss to the company. The other customers were subsidizing the business of these losing customer accounts. Another company found that a mere 15% of their customers accounted for 90% of their profits. You might have a gut feel for who those losing or very profitable customers are, but in the absence of numbers behind it, it's just an opinion. And you can't do much with that. As I've heard it said before, your opinions are fine, but bring your data. Okay, so now what do we do with this new data once acquired? Maybe you start by firing those unprofitable customers. Now, I wouldn't advise doing that, or at least not unless there are prospective and highly profitable customers waiting in the wings that we're not currently serving because existing non-profitable customers take up the needed capacity. You could wave those new customers in from the wings and bring them onto into the fold, but that's a rare situation. Rather, we might first see if we can make those underperforming customers profitable. After all, they already know our products and services, and it's cheaper to sell to existing customers than to try to win over new ones. Can you find more cost-effective ways to provide the service, especially in ways that are invisible to the customer, not impacting the look, feel, or function of your products and services? That should be your first option, to make any internal changes you can that would make doing business with these customers more lucrative. Another reason not to fire customers is because we still have to pay the bills that our contribution analysis does not incorporate. All of those overhead costs that I told you not to include in the analysis, like the cost of facilities and equipment that are shared in serving a multitude of customers. If cash flow dictates it, you may have to serve unprofitable customers, at least in the short term, to pay those bills. A final reason not to fire customers is because it can cause ripples of ill will in the market. You don't want the bad rap to spread that you're an unkind company to customers. When you must do something more explicit in dealing with these disappointing customers, one option is to raise the price to gain margins. Another is to adjust the product or service in some way. You could take these actions across the board affecting all customers, or you could be more selective. That is, offer different products, services, and/or prices to different customers. This is an age-old practice in business-to-business marketing, where there's low transparency in the market in terms of what different customers receive and at what price. Such a practice has been heresy in business-to-consumer marketing, since One, information is more visible in the public marketplace among consumers. And two, some might view the practice of differential pricing as discriminatory or unfair in a consumer setting. But that is changing. Think about your rewards programs or store and loyalty memberships that support lower prices, different products, and advanced services in exchange for your loyal patronage and your willingness to share your purchasing data and preferences with the provider. Do you think that the free upgrades to first class on airlines are random? Hardly. Those perks are reserved for the most loyal customers who often buy the premium services. So offering differentiated service to various customers is rampant. And it's smart business. The point is, we right-size the service for the contribution margins we enjoy with different customers. The insight you gain by comparing customer demands and resource consumption can allow you to move to a more menu-based arrangement for your products and services. That should ensure that every one of your business's transactions has a fair shot at profitability. This is only possible when you have a good grasp on what it costs you to perform distinct activities. At least making a profit won't be a matter of pure chance. Keep in mind that financial measures like revenue, profit, and contribution are backward-looking metrics. Yet, the past is one good predictor of what you can expect in the future. So use them to replace your assumptions with knowledge and bring the lights up on your business.
This lecture is titled, Leveraging Your Supply Chain.
Among the most pervasive developments in all of business over the past few decades is the emergence of supply chain management. There's much confusion around the term and what it means exactly. Stitching together the patchwork of advertisements appearing on television and other media, it appears to involve a lot of action. Warehouses moving products along high-speed conveyors, giant container ships cruising over the ocean, airplanes in flight, and extensive arrays of information technologies. It also seems to feature an alphabet soup of confusing acronyms. Those impressions aren't entirely wrong, but a more complete understanding of supply chain management, or SCM as I'll refer to it, can paint a picture of why every organization needs to assess its supply chains to leverage their potential for competitive advantage. The concept of SCM overlaps in various ways with topics we've examined before, such as supply management and logistics and distribution. But it's developed as a distinct discipline with its own valuable concepts and strategies into a higher order of operations management. As you'll recall, a supply chain is the network of companies that works together to provide a good or service for the end-use market. Allow me to emphasize a couple of terms here. First, network. The supply chain is a network of companies. You probably understand by now that most companies today are not islands all to themselves. They rely on suppliers to provide them with goods, materials, and equipment that then allows them to serve customers. So most companies are embedded in networks of suppliers and customers. Next, end-use market. This is a generic term that refers to users of the products and services at the end of the supply chain. End-users might be consumers, or they might be businesses or institutions. Anyone or any organization that ultimately makes use of the product or service. So what then does it mean to manage a supply chain? It means managing the network of suppliers and customers to achieve the greatest possible effectiveness for the benefit of your organization. Now, it should already be clear that in order for our organization to win in the long term, it's essential that we work with really strong suppliers and customers. But we need to ensure that these outside parties are benefiting from the arrangements too. In this sense, supply chain management should be considered a team sport. Let me share my favorite example of that approach. Coca-Cola and Pepsi are among the most intense of head-to-head competitors out there. They duke it out in virtually every beverage category in the U.S. and abroad. It's heated. For years and years, both companies have purchased fructose corn syrup, a key ingredient in their respective soft drinks, from a company called Cargill. Cargill is a quiet giant. The Minnesota-based grain marketer is among the 10 largest companies in America with annual sales of almost $140 billion. During the early 2000s, Cargill sought to be known for something more than marketing commodities. It wanted to be known as an innovator in the food industry. It ran a vast ad campaign with the tagline, "Collaborate, create, succeed." That's how Cargill works with customers. Well, apparently Coca-Cola decided to take Cargill up on the offer of collaboration by seeking an alternative sweetener to corn syrup, which was being blamed for the expanding waistlines of Americans. As it turned out, Cargill had been working on an all-new sweetener, an extract of the now-famous stevia plant. The sweetener promised to be the perfect sweetener. It was all natural, very sweet, with zero calories. But the sweetener had a somewhat bitter aftertaste that Cargill had not yet been able to resolve. Being experts in the food industry themselves, folks at Coca-Cola agreed to help with the development of this new sweetener. And together, the companies devised what we now know as Truvia, an alternative to sugar and artificial sweeteners, taking the product to market together in 2008. The stevia extract is also found in several Coca-Cola beverages, like zero-calorie waters, low-calorie juices, and soft drinks, all of which are robust beverage markets in what had been a flat industry in terms of growth for several years. The story goes that Pepsi took interest in the stevia plant too, but they had to find their own partner, since Cargill was already spoken for by Coca-Cola. Pepsi decided to work with Chicago-based Marisant to extract the magic from the stevia plant. But unfortunately for Pepsi, Marisant filed for Chapter 11 reorganization in 2009, which delayed the development of Pepsi's competitive products. Finally, in 2010, Marisant and Pepsi marketed Purevia, a rival to Truvia, and released soft drinks with their own stevia-derived sweetener. But Coca-Cola, by that time, had enjoyed almost a 2-year head start. What's interesting about this example is that it's not just a story about competition between Coca-Cola and Pepsi. Rather, it's Coca-Cola's supply chain versus Pepsi's supply chain. Coca-Cola won that round by convincing Cargill to align with it. But keep in mind that the competition doesn't end there. It goes all the way down to the retail level and beyond. Coca-Cola and Pepsi products are found in virtually every grocery store in America. But on the July 4 holiday, only one will enjoy the end-of-aisle displays and cooperative promotion activity in any given store. Soft drink makers pay for these arrangements through their trade spend. Pull a store manager aside, and if they're honest, they'll tell you which company they prefer to do business with. Even Wall Street is catching on to the importance of supply chain management. A company's value is no longer tied merely to past performance and expectations for the future in terms of new products on the horizon. No, the relationships that the company forms with its strategic customers and suppliers also factor into its worth. A company with a better portfolio of customers or favorable relations with the best suppliers will be valued more highly than its competition. So there's actually equity in those business relationships. When you accept that supply chain management is a team sport, you've adopted what's called a supply chain orientation. A company with a supply chain orientation looks to leverage the capabilities and resource advantages offered by its outside partners in the supply chain. Some companies are much more adept at leveraging these external resources than others. An example of a company that's often admired for its supply chain orientation is Procter & Gamble, which I've mentioned before. As the world's largest provider of consumer packaged goods and the owner of 25 different brands that generate $1 billion or more in annual revenues, P&G is an engine of innovation. The company employs about 8,000 people across its 26 R&D centers around the world, spending about $2 billion each year in coming up with and testing new product ideas. As of the date of this lecture, P&G's long-term CEO is A.G. Lafley, who is serving as the company's chief executive for the second time after coming out of retirement. Mr. Lafley imposed a major challenge on his company. Despite the immense resources the company invested each year and the success it had achieved in turning ideas into market-winning products, Mr. Lafley believed that it wasn't enough. Rather than investing further in internal research and development, he developed what's known as a Connect and Develop strategy, or C&D as it's known. He set the peculiar and seemingly impossible goal of having more than 50% of all new product innovations originate from outside the company. He encouraged the company to work with existing and prospective customers and suppliers. The idea was to engage more also with universities, think tanks, and users of the products. Anyone who had a good idea to lend. The PG Connect website is an open source innovation portal that is loaded with product examples that have evolved out of C&D, including Tide Pods, a laundry solution packaged in small, water-soluble, round packets. This one product line grossed nearly $500 million in sales in 2013, its first year on the market. While the goal of achieving so many great ideas in an open source fashion seems ambitious, maybe even outlandish, and certainly so at the time, the company has far surpassed the 50% threshold. What Mr. Lafley was doing was leveraging the hidden value in the supply chain network. Clearly, there's more that can flow through a supply chain than merely inventory and cash. The supply chain can be an invaluable source of good ideas. So how do you start leveraging your company's supply chain? The first step is to understand its network structure. Whom do you buy from? And who do you sell to? The answers to these questions represent your tier one or immediate suppliers and customers. Of course, in most cases, your suppliers also have suppliers, which we call your tier two suppliers. And your customers often have customers, which would be your tier two customers. But to start, it's important that we understand the immediate suppliers and customers that your company works with. And I recommend that you actually map this series of relationships, both upstream and downstream, with suppliers and customers. Not merely recognizing with whom you do business, but thinking also about the nature of that business. Let's think about downstream customer relationships to start. Are there some customers that are more important to your business? What share of your business goes toward these customers? As we've seen before, it's quite common for 80% of a company's revenues to come from 20% of its customers. Once you understand who your customers are and the volume and nature of your business, of the business you do with them, you should step back and think about how comfortable or uncomfortable that portfolio of customer relationships makes you feel. Are there customers on whom you feel overly dependent? Are there opportunities left on the table with others? These are the relationships calling for more attention. So far, the supply chain examples I've shared come from really big companies, the multi-billion dollar giants. The question I often receive is whether or not supply chain management is only the domain for really big companies, like the Coca-Colas and Procter & Gamble's. The simple answer is no. With regard to those relationships on which you feel overly dependent, there's a very simple yet powerful expression that comes into play here. And I use the word powerful with tongue in cheek, because that's what I'm seeking to explain. Power. Picture this mathematical expression. P subscript AB equals D subscript BA. Here P refers to power and D refers to dependence. A and B are independent parties. Consider them as people, groups, organizations. What the expression then says is that the power that A has over B is a function of how dependent B is upon A. Let's insert people into this expression. I'm not too proud to admit that I'm very dependent upon Mrs. Goldsby. And as a result, she exerts almost unchecked power over me. Anyone who knows me and Mrs. Goldsby, they'll concur with that statement. I won't ask you to assess your own personal situation, but I think you'll agree that this simple expression often sums up how and why things happen across independent entities. It explains interpersonal relations. I might argue that it also explains international relations. Why we care so much about what happens in some pockets of the world and less about others. So how does PAB equals DBA apply in the business of supply chains? When one company is very dependent upon another, in our equation, B is very dependent upon A, then party A can exert a lot of power and influence in its dealings with B. This can manifest in many ways. Pricing and sales terms, delivery options, and preferential treatment of all kinds. In extreme situations, the power imbalance can border on abusive relations where a powerful customer demands pricing concessions, special handling of product, unique services, and high levels of relationship-specific resources, including people, technology, and other assets. In these circumstances, it's essential for a company to understand its cost of doing business and know when it must push back against such a customer. We discussed the importance of knowing contribution margins in a previous lecture. But beyond mere resistance of egregious customer demands, the company can also step back and think creatively about how some sense of power balance can be achieved in the relationship. Is it possible that we, as a company, can make ourselves indispensable to this customer, making us just as influential on them, at least in this one category in which we compete for the customer's interest? That is the trick of supply chain management, and small firms do this all the time. In Kentucky, people love their basketball and their bourbon. But there's also a soft drink called L81 that every grocer had better stock. Outside the confines of the Commonwealth, few people have heard of this drink's small Winchester, Kentucky producer. But when you're having a late one in Kentucky, get it? A late one? L81? Then there's nothing better than that drink. Even the giant grocers like Kroger and Walmart know that the soft drink aisle with its Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and Dr. Pepper is incomplete without L81. Competing among monolithic companies and selling through massive retailers, the little company has leveraged its intensely loyal following to make itself a force to be reckoned with when working with retailers. In that way, the power is quite balanced between L8, as it's known, and those giant retailers. By the way, everything that I've just shared in terms of power and dependence in customer relations also applies in terms of working with suppliers. You need to assess your relative position with suppliers and figure out which ones are most important for your business and concern yourself with how to become the preferred customer to those critical suppliers. Figure out how to align them and how to get them to join your team. Research shows that the highest performing business relationships are those in which there is a level of codependence. When the dependence only goes one way, then the powerful party will usually extract any and everything that it can from the relationship, and the weaker party will be regarded as dispensable. That's not the position in which you want to find yourself, in the eyes of valuable customers or critical suppliers. Certainly, economic power can be one way to garner respect, as in being a major customer to suppliers. Yet there are other ways to endear your business to suppliers. Like being easy to do business with. That's one important way. Bringing forward ideas for product and process innovations for the supplier is another way. And if all else fails, consider recognizing your best suppliers. Who doesn't like to receive an award? Is the idea then to form as many strategic relationships as possible with your customers and suppliers? Well, that just isn't possible or advisable. Each close relationship requires a lot of investment. It might also involve dedicating not just a single person, but possibly a team of people to work on an important account. A team assigned to work with a highly prized customer might require a diverse set of skills, engaging not just sales, but product engineering, marketing, and logistics, among others. This team might even reside at the customer location. It's this kind of commitment that author Tom Friedman describes in his best-selling book, The World is Flat, where he describes the immense growth of the small town of Bentonville, Arkansas, in size and diversity over the past few decades. The growth comes primarily from vendors serving Walmart. The vendors send armies of people to the small northwest Arkansas town to serve the behemoth retailer. In fact, Friedman jokes that you can actually find decent sushi there now. Well, I can't vouch for that, but it's clear that this collection of vendors values the relationship with Walmart immensely to invest so extensively. And that's understandable when that one customer generates anywhere from 15 to 40% of your sales, which is typical of consumer goods companies selling to and through Walmart. Certainly not every customer will warrant such an investment. It comes down to a fundamental economic question. How can we best employ limited resources for the greatest possible benefit? Resources permitting, you might assign a diverse team of professionals to work closely with your most valuable customers. You might dedicate a customer service line for exclusive use by these customers and be willing to devise wholly unique service agreements. But again, these arrangements are extremely resource intensive. Where such investment is not possible or deemed worthwhile, you might dedicate a single individual to the account and be willing to offer some unique products and services. For the remaining customers, you seek to be easy to do business with, offering convenient store hours, an online presence, and perhaps a large catalog of products, and customer service personnel ready to help, whatever the competitive climate dictates. But you offer little customization or unique resource investment to the masses in these relationships. Is it because you're cold and uncaring? No, there simply aren't enough resources to make demonstrative investments in these marginal relationships. This is changing somewhat, though, and in ways that we as consumers experience every day. The growth in loyalty programs and analytics is helping to provide low-cost forms of personal attention in mass customized relationships. This is possible by virtue of tracking individual customer interest and buying behavior. Out of the intelligence gathered from big data analytics, companies are figuring out where customization and more personal touch in the relationship might be warranted. Yet there's no denying that it can be very expensive to treat a customer like royalty. So you have to be very selective. Be especially careful when assessing the value of a customer relationship. If you rely solely on past sales, you might be overlooking tomorrow's stars. Consider Starbucks as one example. Back in 1984, the company was transitioning from a small artisanal coffee bean roaster to a budding coffee store chain. Longtime CEO Howard Schultz had fallen in love with Italian-style coffee shops during his travels and was looking to expand Starbucks from its 7 Seattle-area stores at the time to a national chain. But when Solo Cup Company had to decide whether to work with Starbucks, at first, all it could see was just a little Seattle operation. Yet had Solo Cup, which is now part of Dark Container, had they passed on the business, it might not be the primary provider to Starbucks' more than 18,000 locations in 62 countries today. The company would have missed the opportunity to hitch itself to Starbucks and enjoy its meteoric rise. You can use the same kind of analysis when considering your supplier relationships. Some suppliers will be more important than others, and these are the ones that deserve extra attention. These might be suppliers that possess unique materials, higher quality, better value, or intangibles like innovation in products and processes. Of course, there may also be troubled suppliers that are essential to your business, yet struggling with quality, cost, or delivery. These suppliers may deserve extra attention too. The management of supplier relationships requires an understanding of which outside entities are poised to help us most, not only today, but into the future. And there's something of a race to lock in these choice suppliers. At The Ohio State University, we have a research center called the Global Supply Chain Forum, headed by Professor Douglas Lambert. The forum has helped to define the field of supply chain management with a framework dedicated to advancing the state of art and practice of SCM. Beyond recognizing that every firm resides in a supply chain network, the forum framework is built on 8 key business processes. This lecture has emphasized customer and supplier relationships. The first 2 processes of the framework focus on these important aspects of right-sizing business relationships through processes known as customer relationship management, CRM, and supplier relationship management, SRM. There are 6 additional processes, including customer service management, demand management, manufacturing flow management, order fulfillment, product development and commercialization, and returns management. While CRM and SRM represent the key linkages in the supply chain, the other 6 processes represent the work that must take place across functions to create and transfer value through engagement in the supply chain network, especially with select suppliers and choice customers in the network. In case it's not already obvious, supply chain management should not be the work of a single department in your company, even though you might have a department that bears supply chain in its name. At Ohio State, we believe very much that supply chain management requires the involvement of all business functions. If SCM is a team, to make the right decisions for business, figure out how to compete and produce the greatest possible returns for the company and its shareholders. So SCM is really a team sport at 2 different levels. The first, getting all the functions coordinated within the company, that's what we call internal integration. And the second, leveraging business relationships with choice customers and select suppliers, figuring out how to go to market together. This is what we refer to as external integration. Small businesses have something of an advantage when it comes to internal integration. They can usually align themselves better and faster than their larger, more complex competitors. Decision-making is usually more concentrated in smaller firms, and arguably employees in smaller firms demonstrate a greater concern for the success of the business. The work of each individual can be more easily traced to the company's bottom line performance. Where there's better internal integration, the company is poised to realize the greatest benefits of integration with external partners too. In contrast, big companies are often laden with bureaucracy, and the company's different functions and departments may be hampered by competing interests and objectives that are reinforced with conflicting functional performance measures. It can be extremely difficult just to get your own house in order in large, complex organizations. On the upside, however, big companies often find it easier to collaborate with outside companies because of their economic power and size. They can often cast a shadow over their suppliers and even on customers, as our discussion of power and dependence indicated. They're also more likely to invest in integrative technologies and to dedicate teams of people to important business relationships that warrant the investment. So while small companies find it easier to be cohesive within the company, larger companies have the wherewithal to work more closely with outside partners in the supply chain. If possible, however, you'll want your company to do both. Even though your company may not have fully dedicated suppliers or customers that promise not to buy from your competitors, supply chain management and the teamwork that it involves can still be effective. The linkages we see in the supply chain network convey much more than product flowing from one company to another and cash flowing in the reverse direction. No, there's an affiliation effect present here. Companies take pride in their portfolios of customers and suppliers. They take pride in the deep business relationships that they develop, such that the companies forming the best and often most lucrative business relationships will succeed into the indefinite future. Customers and suppliers will band together in difficult times, and the parties will come away feeling glad to be bound together. There will be a common identity, as if they're, well, playing on the same team. Henry Ford's efforts to vertically integrate the Ford Motor Company in the 1920s are legendary. But even he ultimately realized that vertical integration has its limits. He eventually realized that owning and managing resources from raw material extraction through production and distribution was neither a viable nor sustainable model for competitive success. Today's global competition makes vertical integration even less practical in most cases and has accelerated the rise of outsourcing. Now, I'm not implying that outsourcing is good or bad per se, but competition has driven companies to specialize on core competencies, those things they do better than anyone else. At Ford Motor Company, today, this means focusing on the design and final assembly of automobiles. They leave raw material processing and component manufacturing to their suppliers. And on the outbound side of the auto assembly operation, the company relies on authorized dealers to sell cars to buyers as extensions of the Ford Motor Company. As I've previously discussed, countless other industries are also outsourcing work that was once performed in-house. Everything from fashion brands to consumer electronics manufacturers now assume primary responsibilities for designing products and building the brand rather than building the products themselves. In some cases, it appears that retailers are stretching upstream in the supply chain by way of producing private label products. Yet it's rare that a grocery retailer, for instance, would fulfill the manufacturing role itself. Instead, they're more likely to hire a manufacturer to manufacture the goods on their behalf. All of these examples underscore the criticality of managing business relationships, asking outside companies to act on your behalf, in your best interest. Again, this is not to say that all business relationships should be formed and treated as high-potential strategic relationships. Again, supply chain management calls for selective engagement. It's an economic necessity, as there's simply not enough time or resources to go around. I believe that forming the right relationships and managing them well is the next great source of competitive advantage for companies. Supply chain relations are dyadic within each link of the chain. Each link requires two parties to offer genuine value to each other. In order to receive the best that others have to offer, you also have to bring forward the good yourself. When you can form these mutually beneficial relationships with the best suppliers and customers, then you can fairly say that you've won. Your reward will be improved economic returns, innovation, adaptability, and growth. Regardless of whether you work in a Fortune 100 global company or run a single shop family business, these are outcomes you can live with.
This lecture is titled Reducing Risk, Building Resilience.
In early 2000, mobile phone manufacturers Nokia and Ericsson were locked in a tight battle for mobile phone supremacy. Both companies relied on semiconductor chips produced by Royal Philips at its Albuquerque, New Mexico plant. When lightning sparked a small fire at the factory in March 2000, both phone manufacturers found themselves in a jam. The fire was contained and extinguished in less than 10 minutes, but millions of smoke and water-damaged chips had to be scrapped. The divergent reactions of the two companies to the mishap would alter the course of history for both companies. Nokia quickly implemented its crisis plan to acquire capacity from Philips' other factories and to enlist additional chip producers to shore up the loss of supply. They even re-engineered the design of some of their phone models to function with different chips, chips that were readily available. Nokia's market share jumped from 25% to 30% in the immediate aftermath. Ericsson, on the other hand, Ericsson let more than 2 weeks pass before reacting to the fire. The company found itself with no real plan or any good alternatives available since Nokia had already secured the supply of compatible chips. Ericsson Mobile Communications lost $570 million in that quarter and over $2.3 billion for the year.